though. Many of the heads are thrown back and attached to Molson bottles. Green's jacket creaks as he tries to breathe. The snake had leapt from the can with a sound like sprung. His aunt at the Winchester breakfast nook, in dazzling winter dawnlight, quietly doing a word search puzzle. Two dormer windows are half blocked by the throbbing rectangles of the JBLs. Green's the type that can recognize a JBL speaker and Molson Green bottle from way far away. A developed thought coheres. Ho's voice has the quality of a type of ointment. Any displaced and shaggy nook head in these windows, chancing to look out into the yard now, would be able to probably see Lance depositing another chunk of meat in front of the pet, and removing something from up near his shoulder under his top coat as he's melting stealthily all the way around behind the dog, to sort of straddle the big dog from the rear, easing the last of the loaf down in front of the dog, the big dog hunched, the crunch of Don's cornflake topping, and the gooey sound of a dog eating institutional meat. The arm comes out from under the coat and goes up with something that looks like it would glitter if the window's yard light reached far enough. Bruce Green keeps trying to wave his breath out of the way. Lentz's fine coat billows around the dog's flanks as Lentz braces and leans and gathers the hunched thing's scruff in one hand and straightens up with a mighty grunting hoist that brings the animal up onto its hind legs as its front legs dig frantically at empty air, and the dog's whine brings a lay and flannel shape to the lit space above one speaker overhead. Green doesn't even think of calling out from his shadowed spot, and the moment hangs there with the dog upright and Lentz behind it, bringing the upraised hand down in front and hard across the dog's throat. There's a lightless arc from the spot Lentz's hand crossed. The arc splatters the gate and the sidewalk outside it. The music balloons without cease, but Green hears Lentz say what sounds like, "How dare you?" with great emphasis, as he drops the dog forward under the yard, as there's a high-pitched male sound from the form at the window. And the dog goes down and hits the ground on its side with the meaty crunch of a 32-kilo bag of party-sized cubelets, all four legs dog-paddling uselessly, the dark surface of the lawn blackening in a pulsing curve before its jaws that open and close. Green has moved, unthinking, out of the van shadow toward Lentz, and now thinks and stops between two trees by the street in front of 416, wanting to call to Lentz and feeling the strangled aphasia people feel in bad dreams, and so just stands there between the tree trunks with a finger in one ear, looking. The way Lentz stands over the hull of the big dog is like you stand over a punished child, at full height and radiating authority, and the moment hangs there distended like that until there's the shriek of long shut windows opening against the hoe and the dire sound of numerous high-tempo loggers' boots rushing downstairs inside 412. The creepily friendly bachelor that lived next to his aunt had had two big groomed dogs, and when Bruce passed the house, the dog's toenails would scrabble on the wood of the front porch and run with their tails up to the anodized fence as Bruce came by and jump up and like sort of play the metal fence with their paws, excited to see him, to just, like, set eyes on him. Lentz's arm with the knife is up again and ungleaming in the streetlight's light as Lentz uses his other hand on the top of the fence to vault the fence sideways and tear ass uphill up Brainerd Road in the southwest direction of Enfield, his loafers making a quality sound on the pavement and his open coat filling like a sail. Green retreats to behind one of the trees as beefy flannel forms with leis shedding petals, their speech grunty foreign and unmistakably Canadian, a couple with ukuleles, spill out like ants over the sagging porch and into the yard, mill and jabber, a couple kneel by the form of the former dog. A bearded guy so huge a Hawaiian shirt looks tight on him has picked up the meatloaf's baggie. Another guy without very much hair picks what looks like a white caterpillar out of the dark grass and holds it up delicately between his thumb and finger, looking at it. Yet another huge guy in suspenders drops his beer and picks up the limp dog, and it lies across his arms on its back with its head way back like a swooned girl, dripping and with one leg still going, and the guy is either screaming or singing. The original massive Nook with the baggy clutches his head to signal agitation as he and two other Nooks run heavily to the slingshot Montego. A first floor light in the house across Brainerd lights up, and backlights a figure in a sort of suit and metal wheelchair, sitting upright next to the window, in the sideways way of wheelchairs that want to get right up next to something, scanning the street and Nook-swarmed yard. The Hawaiian music has apparently stopped, but not abruptly. It's not like somebody took it off in the middle. Green has retreated to behind a tree, which he sort of one-arm hugs. A thick girl in a horrible grass skirt is saying "Dieu" several times. There are obscenities and heavily accented stock phrases like "stop" and "there he goes," with pointing. Several guys are running up the sidewalk after Lance, but they're in boots, and Lance is way ahead, and now disappears as he cuts like a tailback left and disappears down either an alley or a serious driveway, though you can still hear his fine shoes. One of the guys actually shakes his fist as he gives chase. The Montego with the twin cam reveals muffler problems and clunks down off the curb and lays two parentheses as it 180s professionally around in the middle of the street and peels out up in Lentz's direction. A very low and fast and no-shit car. Its antennas gay lay, tugged by speed into a strained ellipse and leaving a wake of white petals that take forever to stop falling. Green thinks his finger might be frozen to his ears inside. Nobody seems to be gesticulating about anything about maybe an accomplice. There's no evidence they're looking around for any other unwittingly guilty accessory-type party. Another wheelchaired form has appeared just behind and to the right of the first seated, backlit form across the street, and they're both in a position to see Green up against the tree with his hand to his ear. So it looks like he's maybe receiving communiques from some kind of earpiece. The Nooks are still milling around the yard in a way that's indescribably foreign, as the one Nook staggers in circles under the weight of the expired dog, saying something to the sky. Green is getting to know this one tree very well, spread out against its lee side and breathing into the bark of the tree, so his exhaled breath won't plume out from behind the tree and be seen as an accomplice's breath, potentially. Mario Incandenza's 19th birthday will be Wednesday, the 25th of November, the day before Thanksgiving. His insomnia worsens as Madame Psychosis's hiatus enters its third week, and WYYY tries bringing back poor Miss Diagnosis again, who started in on a Pig Latin reading of the Revelation of John that makes you so embarrassed for her, it's uncomfortable. For a couple nights in the headmaster's house living room, he tries falling asleep to WODS, an AM fringe outfit that plays narcotizing orchestral arrangements of old Carpenter's songs. It makes things worse. It's weird to feel like you miss someone you're not even sure you know. He gets a serious burn on his pelvis leaning against a hot steel stove, talking to Mrs. Clark. His hip is swaddled in bandages under Oren's old corduroys, and there's a sucking sound of salve when he walks, late at night, unable to sleep. The birth-related disability that wasn't even definitively diagnosed until Mario was 6, and had let Oren tattoo his shoulder with the red coil of an immersion heater, is called familial dysautonomia, a neurological deficit whereby he can't feel physical pain very well. A lot of the ETAs kid him about they should have such problems, and even Hal's sometimes felt a twinge of envy about it. But the defect is a serious hassle, and actually very dangerous. See, for instance, the burnt pelvis, which wasn't even discovered until Mrs. Clark thought she smelled her eggplant overcooking. At the headmaster's house, he lies on the air mattress in a tight down bag on the edge of the violet plant light, with the wind rattling the big east window, listening to buttery violins and what sounds like a zither. There's sometimes a scream upstairs, shrill and drawn out, from where CT's and the mom's rooms are. Mario listens closely for whether the sound ends up as Avril laughing or Avril screaming. She gets night terrors, which are like nightmares but worse, and which afflict small children, but apparently also adults who eat the day's biggest meal right before bed. His nighttime prayers take almost an hour, and sometimes more, and are not a chore. He doesn't kneel. It's more like a conversation. And he's not crazy. It's not like he hears anybody or anything conversing back with him, Hal's established. Hal had asked him when he'll start coming back to their room to sleep, which made Mario feel good. He keeps trying to imagine Madame Psychosis, whom he imagines as being very tall, lying in an extra-large beach chair on a beach, smiling and not saying anything for days, resting. But it doesn't work very well. He can't tell if Hal is sad. He is having a harder and harder time reading Hal's states of mind or whether he's in good spirits. This worries him. He used to be able to sort of pre-verbally know in his stomach, generally, where Hal was and what he was doing, even if Hal was far away and playing, or if Mario was away. And now, he can't anymore. Feel it. This worries him, and feels like when you've lost something important in a dream, and you can't even remember what it was, but it's important. Mario loves Hal so much, it makes his heart beat hard. He doesn't have to wonder if the difference now is him or his brother, because Mario never changes. He hadn't told the moms he was going to walk around after he left her office, after their interface. Avril usually tries, in a non-intrusive way, to discourage Mario from taking walks at night, because he doesn't see well at night, and the areas around the ETA hill are not the best neighborhood, and there's no skirting the fact that Mario would be easy prey for just about anybody, physically. And though one perk of familial dysautonomia is a relative physical fearlessness, Mario keeps to a pretty limited area during insomniacal strolls, out of deference to Avril's worry. He'll sometimes walk around the grounds of the Enfield Marine PHH at the bottom of the hill's east side, because they're pretty much enclosed, the grounds are. And he knows a couple of the EM security officers, from when his father got them to portray Boston police in his whimsical Dial C for Concupiscence. And he likes the EM grounds at night because the different brick houses' window light is yellow lamplight. And he can see people on the ground floors all together playing cards, or talking, or watching TP. He also likes whitewashed brick, regardless of its state of upkeep. And a lot of the people in the different brick houses are damaged or askew and lean hard to one side or are twisted into themselves through the windows, and he can feel his heart going out into the world through them, which is good for insomnia. A woman's voice calling for help without any real urgency. Not like the screams that signify the mom's laughing or screaming at night. Sounds from a darkened upper window. And across the little street that's crammed with cars, everybody has to move at 0-100 hours, is Enid's house, where the headmistress has a disability, and it had a wheelchair ramp installed, and has twice invited Mario in during the day for a caffeine-free millennial fizzy. And Mario likes the place. It's crowded and noisy, and none of the furniture has protective plastic wrap, but nobody notices anybody else or comments on a disability. And the headmistress is kind to the people, and the people cry in front of each other. The inside of it smells like an ashtray, but Mario's felt good both times in Enid's house because it's very real. People are crying and making noise and getting less unhappy. And once he heard somebody say God with a straight face, and nobody looked at them, or looked down, or smiled in any sort of way where you could tell they were worried inside. People from the public can't be in there after 2300 hours, though, because they have a curfew. So Mario just totters past on the broken sidewalk and looks in the ground windows at all the different people. Every window is lit up with light, and some are slid partly open, and there is the noise of being outside a house full of people. From one of the upstairs windows facing the street comes a voice going, "Give it here, give it here." Someone is crying, and someone else is either laughing or coughing very hard. An irritable man's voice from a kitchen window at the side says something to somebody else that just said something like, "So get dentures," followed by curse words. Another upstairs window, over at the side by the wheelchair ramp and the kitchen window, where the ground is soft enough to take the stress of a police lock and lead block nicely, the upper window has a billowing lengthwise flag for a curtain and an old bumper sticker on the glass, half scraped off, so it says, "One day at," in cursive. And Mario is arrested by the quiet but unmistakable sound of a recording of a broadcast of 60 minutes, more or less, with Madame Psychosis, which Mario has never taped a show of, because he feels it wouldn't be right for him, but is strangely thrilled to hear someone in Ennitz thinking enough of to tape and replay. What's coming from behind the open window with the billowing flag for a curtain is one of the old ones, from the year of the Wonder Chicken, Madame's inaugural year, when she'd sometimes talk all hour and had an accent. A hard east wind blows Mario's thin hair straight back off his head. His standing angle is 50 degrees. A female girl in a little fur coat and uncomfortable-looking blue jeans and tall shoes clicks past on the sidewalk and goes up the ramp into Ennett's back door without indicating she saw somebody with a really big head standing, braced by a police lock on the lawn outside the kitchen window. The lady had had on so much makeup she'd looked unwell, but the wake of her passage smells very good. For some reason, Mario felt like the person behind the flag in the window was also a female. Mario thinks it might not be out of the question that she might lend tapes to a fellow listener, if he could ask. He usually checks etiquette questions with Hal, who is incredibly knowledgeable and smart. When he thinks of Hal, his heart beats, and his forehead's thick skin becomes wrinkled. Hal will also know the term for private tapes made of broadcast things on the air. Perhaps this lady owns multiple tapes. This one is from 60 Minutes, more or less,'s first year, when Madame still had a slight accent and often spoke on the show, as if she were talking exclusively to one person or character who was very important to her. The moms reveal that if you're not crazy, then speaking to someone who isn't there is termed apostrophe and is valid art. Mario'd fallen in love with the first Madame Psychosis programs because he felt like he was listening to someone sad read out loud from yellow letters she'd taken out of a shoebox on a rainy PM. Stuff about heartbreak and people you loved dying and U.S. woe. Stuff that was real. It is increasingly hard to find valid art that is about stuff that is real in this way. The older Mario gets, the more confused he gets about the fact that everyone at ETA over the age of about Kent Blott finds stuff that's really real, uncomfortable, and they get embarrassed. It's like there's some rule that real stuff can only get mentioned if everybody rolls their eyes or laughs in a way that isn't happy. The worst feeling thing that happened today was at lunch, when Michael Pemulis told Mario he had an idea for setting up a dial-a-prayer telephone service for atheists, in which the atheist dials the number, and the line just rings and rings, and no one answers. It was a joke, and a good one, and Mario got it. What was unpleasant was that Mario was the only one at the big table whose laugh was a happy laugh. Everybody else sort of looked down like they were laughing at somebody with a disability. The whole issue was far above Mario's head, and he was unable to understand Lyle's replies when he tried to bring the confusion up. And Hal was, for once, no help, because Hal seemed even more uncomfortable and embarrassed than the fellows at lunch, and when Mario brought up real stuff, Hal called him boo-boo and acted like he'd wet himself, and Hal was going to be very patient about helping him change. A lot of people are appearing out of the dark and walking by to go in for the curfew. They all seem afraid and scowl to pretend they're not shy. The men have their hands in their coat pockets, and the females have their hands at their coats' throats, keeping them shut. One young person Mario's never seen sees him struggling with the police lock and helps him disengage the bar and get the lead block into his backpack. Just that little bit of help that makes the difference. Mario is suddenly so sleepy he's not sure he can get up the hill to go home. The musics that played at the beginning of Madame Psychosis's career are the exact same that played to the end. What sounds so unacceptable without her there. Mario's forward list is perfect for walking uphills, however. His pelvis's salve makes a sound but doesn't hurt. In the big protruding window of Ennett's house's headmistress's office, that the window overlooks the avenue and the train tracks and the Ning's clean father and son grocery, where they give Mario yellow tea in the AM when he comes by when it's cold, the last thing Mario can see, before the hillside's trees close behind him and reduce the Ennett house to shattered yellow lighting, is a wide, square-headed boy, bent over something he's writing at the headmistress's black desk, licking a pencil end, and hunched all uncomfortably with one arm curled out around what he's writing in, like a slow boy, over a class theme at Ringe and Latin Special. Live-in staffers' evening duties are divided pretty evenly between the Picayune and the Unpleasant. Somebody has to hit the area meetings to verify residents' attendance, while somebody else has to miss a nightly meeting to man the empty house and phones and do the Picayune daily log. After the meeting's let out, Gately's supposed to do a head count every hour and make a log entry on who all's there and what's going on. Gately has to do a chore patrol and log entry on chore performance and nail down tomorrow's chore assignments off the weekly sheet. The residents need to have everything expected of them spelled out in advance so they can't bitch if they get popped for something. Then people who haven't performed on their chore have to be told they're on a week's restriction, which tends to be unpleasant. Gately has to unlock Pat's cabinets and get the key to the meds locker and open the meds locker. Residents on meds respond to the sound of the meds locker the way a cat will respond to the sound of a can opener. They just, like, materialize. Gately has to dispense oral insulin and virus meds and pimple medicine and antidepressants and lithium to the residents who materialize for meds, and then he has to enter everything in the medical log, which, the medical log is an incredible fucking mess. He has to get out Pat's Week at a Glance book and print out her next day's appointments on a sheet of paper in block letters because Pat finds her own palsied handwriting impossible to read. Gately has to confer with Jeanette Foltz about how different residents conducted themselves at St. E's Sharing and Caring, at Brookline's BYP, and a women's NA step down in East Cambridge they let a couple of the senior females go to, and then log all the data. Gately has to go up and check on Kate G., who claimed to be too sick to hit AA again tonight, and has been in bed in her room more or less steadily for 3 days, reading somebody called Sylvia Plate. Going up onto the women's side of the upstairs is an incredible pain in the ass, because he has to unlock a little steel cage over a little button at the bottom of their stairway by the back office, and press the button to sound an upstairs buzzer, and shout up the stairs, "Mail on the floor!" And then give the female residents as much time as they need to get decent, or whatever, before he can come up. Going up there has been educational for Gately, because he'd always had this idea that women's areas were essentially cleaner and pleasanter than men's areas. Having to verify the chore in the women's two bathrooms smashed his long-standing delusion that women didn't go to the bathroom with the same appalling vigor that men did. Gately'd done a fair amount of cleaning up after his mother, but he never much thought of her as a woman. So, the whole unpleasant thing's been an education. Gately has to check on Dooney Glynn, who has recurrent diverticulitis, and has to lie fetal on his bunk when he gets an attack, and has to be brought Motrin and a slim fast shake that Gately had to make with 2% milk because there was no skim left, and then food bank crackers and a tonic out of the basement's machine when Glynn can't drink the 2% shake, and then log Glynn's comments and condition, neither of which are good. Somebody has made those disgusting marshmallowy Rice Krispie things in the kitchen and then not cleaned up after themselves. And Gately has to clomp around finding out who's responsible and get them to clean it up. And the code about ratting among the residents is such that you'd think he was a narc all of a sudden. The daily bullshit here is hip deep and not so much annoying as soul-sucking. A double shift here now empties him out by dawn, just in time to clean real shit. It hadn't been this way at the start, the soul-sucking aspect, and Gately, every couple minutes, wonders again what he'll end up doing when his year's staff term is up, and his soul is sucked out, and he's sober but without any money, and still clueless, and has to leave here and do something back out there. Kate Gompert, when he buzzed and went up to the five-woman room to look in, had made a possible sideways comment about hurting herself. And Gately has to call Pat at home about it, and she's out or not picking up. So then he has to call the house manager and relay the verbatim comment and let her interpret it and tell Gately what action to take and how the comment stands in relation to Gompert's suicide contract, and how the whole thing should be logged. A resident at Ennett had hung herself from a heating pipe in the basement a couple years before Gately arrived, and there are now Baroque procedures for monitoring ideation among residents with psych issues. The number of 5 East at St. Elizabeth's is on a red card in Pat's Rolodex. Gately has to collect the previous week's counselor reports and collate them, and get the residents' files together, and get any updates or changes printed out and into the files for tomorrow's all-staff meeting, where the staff gets together in Pat's office and interfaces on how each resident seems to be doing. Residents have a pretty good idea that their alumni counselors basically rat them out, in toto, at each staff meeting, which is why counseling sessions tend to be so incredibly dull that only really grateful, giving Ennett alumni are willing to serve as counselors. Filing organization is picayune, and for Gately, using the back office's TP array to print stuff out is unpleasant, mostly because each of his fingers covers almost 3 keys of the keyboard, and he has to hit each key carefully with the tip of a pen, which sometimes he forgets to retract the nub of, leaving blue smears on the keys that the house manager always gives him an ass-chewing for. And Gately has to have each newer resident into the office for at least a couple minutes to, like, touch base and see how they're doing, and make it clear they're regarded as existing, so they can't just melt into the living room's decor and disappear. The newest guy is still sitting in the linen closet, claiming he's comfortablest there with the door open, and the new helpless Amy Johnson hasn't come back yet. A brand new court-ordered female, Ruth Van Cleve, who looks like one of those people you see in pictures of African famine, has to fill out intake forms and go through orientation. And Gately goes over the house rules with her and gives her a copy of the Ennett House Survival Guide, which some resident, years gone, had written for Pat. Gately has to answer the phone and tell people who call the office for a resident that residents can receive calls only on the payphone in the basement, which he has to say, yes, is frequently busy. All the time. The house prohibits cellular/mobiles and has a boundary about the office phone for residents. Gately has to kick residents off down there when other residents in line come and complain they've exceeded their 5 minutes. This also tends to be unpleasant. The payphone down there is undigital and unshut-offable, and a constant source of aggravation and beefs. Every conversation is life and death. Crisis down there 24/7. There's a special way to kick somebody off a payphone that's respectful and non-shaming, but also firm. Gailey has gotten good at assuming a blank but not passive expression when residents are abusive. There's this look of weary expertise the house staffers cultivate. Then they have to flex their face to get rid of when they're off duty. Gailey's gotten so stoic in the face of abuse that a resident has to mention actual unnatural acts in connection with his name for Gately to log the abuse and give out a restriction. He's respected and well-liked by almost all the residents, which the house manager says causes the veteran staff some concern, because Gately's job is not to be these people's friend all the time. Then, in the kitchen, with the fucking crispy treat bowls and pans still a fucking mess, Wade McDade and some other residents were standing around waiting for various things to toast and boil, and McDade was using his finger and pushing the tip of his nose up so that his nostrils faced straight out at everybody. He was looking piggishly around and asking if people knew any people where their nose looked like this right here. And some people said yes. Sure. Why? Gately checked the fridge and again saw evidence that his special meatloaf had a secret admirer. It looked like another big rectangle cut out of the leftovers he'd carefully wrapped and laid out on the sturdiest shelf in there. McDade, who Gately struggles daily with the urge to hit McDade so hard there'd be nothing but eyes and a nose down over the tops of his cowboy boots, McDade's telling everybody he's constructing a gratitude list at Calvin T's tough love suggestion, and he says he's decided one of the things he's grateful for is his nose doesn't look like this here. Gately tries not to judge on the basis of who laughs and who doesn't. When Pat's phone rings and Gately leaves, McDade's squunching his upper lip up in his hand and asking people about acquaintance with cleft palates. Gately has to monitor the, emotional barometer in the house and put a wet finger to the wind for potential conflicts and issues and rumors. A subtle art here is maintaining access to the resident's gossip grapevine and keeping on top of rumors without seeming like you're inducing a resident to cross the line and actually eat cheese on another resident. The only thing a resident is actually encouraged to rat out another resident on here is picking up a substance. All other type issues, it's supposed to be staff's job to glean and ferret out, etc., to decock legitimate infractions out of the tides of innuendo and bullshit complaint, 20-plus bored, crammed together, street-canny people in detox from wrecked lives can generate. Rumors that so-and-so blew so-and-so on the couch at 0300, that thus-and-such's got a knife, that X was using what had to be some kind of code on the payphone, that Y's gone back to carrying a beeper, that so-and-so's making book on football out of the five-man room, that Belbin had led Dial to believe she'd clean up if he made crispy treats, and then she weaseled out, etc. Almost all of it's picayune, and over time, as it accretes, unpleasant. Rarely a feeling of outright, unalloyed sadness as such afterward. Just an abrupt loss of hope. Plus, there is the contempt he belies so well with gentleness and caring during that post-coital period of small sounds and adjustments. Oren can only give, not receive, pleasure, and this makes a contemptible number of them think he is a wonderful lover, almost a dream-type lover, and thus fuels the contempt. But he cannot show the contempt, since this would pretty clearly detract from the subject's pleasure. Because the subject's pleasure in him has become his food, he is conscientious in the consideration and gentleness he shows after coitus, making clear his desire to stay right there, very close and intimate, when so many other male lovers, the subjects say, seem, afterward, to become uneasy, contemptuous, or distant, rolling over to stare at the wall, or tamping down a smoke before they've even stopped twitching. The hand model told him, very softly, how the photographer's big pink Swiss husband, after coitus, hove himself off her and lay there, stunned under his stomach's weight, his eyes narrowed to piggy slits, and the faint smirk on his face, that of a gorged predator. Not like the punter, uncaring. As was SOP with subjects, she became then briefly stricken and anxious and said no one must ever know. She could lose her children. Orne administered the standard assurances in a very soft, intimate voice. Orne was resoundingly gentle and caring afterward, as she could somehow just intuitively tell he would be. It was true. It gave him real pleasure to give the impression of care and intimacy in this interval. If someone asked about his favorite part of the anticlimactic time after the subject lay back and glisteningly opened, and he could see her eyes holding him whole, Orne would say his number two favorite is this post-seminal interval of clingy vulnerability on the subject's part and gentle, intimate care on his own. When the knock on the room door came, it seemed like a further grace, for the subject had been up on an elbow in bed, exhaling slim tusks of cigarette smoke from her nose, and starting to ask him to tell her things about his own family, and Orne was stroking her very tenderly, and watching the twin curves of smoke pale and spread, and trying not to shudder at the thought of what the inside of the subject's fine nose must look like, what gray-white tangles of necrotic snot must hang and twine up in there, from the smoke, whether she had the stomach to look at a hanky she'd used, or whether she balled the thing up and flung it from her with a sort of shudder, oh, knew he'd feel. And when the brisk action of male knuckles sounded against the room's door, he watched her face whiten from the forehead down, as she pleaded that no one must know of her, whoever was there, and stabbed out her butt, and dove beneath the blankets, as he called out for patience to the door, and veered to the bathroom to wrap a towel around him before he went to it, the sort of bland hotel door you used a card and not a key for. The defiled, guilty, and frightened married hand model's wrist and hand protruded for a moment from the edge of the bedding and felt the floor for shoes and clothes, the hand moving like a blind spider and sucking things up under the blankets. Orne didn't ask who it was at the door. He had nothing to hide. His mood at the door became extraordinarily fine. When the wife and mother had erased all evidence of herself and heaped the bedding over her, so she could lie there, sniffing grayly and imagining that she was hidden from view, just one lumpy part of a celibate napper's disheveled bed, Orne checked the door's fisheye peeper, saw only the hallway's claret-colored wall opposite, and opened the door with a smile he felt all the way down to his bare soles. Swiss cuckolds, furtive Near Eastern medical attachés, Zaftig print journalists. He was ready for anything. The man in the hall at the door was handicapped, challenged, in a wheelchair, looking up at him from well below peephole range, bushy-haired, and mostly nose, and looking up into the swell of Orin's pectorals, making no attempt to see around him into the room. One of the disabled. Orne looked down and felt both let down and almost touched. The little fellow's wheelchair, shiny, and his lap blanketed, and his string tie half hidden by the clipboard he held to his chest with a curled and motherly arm. "Serve," the man said, nothing else, joggling the clipboard a little like an infant, presenting it as evidence. Orne imagined the terrified subject, lying there, hidden and trying to hear, and despite a sort of mild disappointment, he felt touched at whatever this shy ruse of an excuse for proximity to his leg and autograph might be. He felt for the subject the sort of clinical contempt you feel for an insect you've looked down and seen and know you're going to torture for a while. From the way she smoked and performed certain other manual operations, Orne had noted she was left-handed. He said to the man in the wheelchair, "Goody. Bless our manis 3% simple. Eager to cooperate in any way?" The man cocked his head in that way people in wheelchairs do. "Scholarly academic study." "Pisser." Leaning against the jamb with arms crossed, watching the man trying to process the dissimilarity in the size of his limbs. No shins or extremities, however withery, extended below the wheelchair's blanket's hem. The guy was, like, totally legless. Oren's rising heart went out.
Chamber of Commerce survey. Certain veterans group. Systematic inquiry. Consumer advocacy polling operation. 3 percentage points error on either of two sides of the issue.
Bully. When the man had taken out his pen with a flourish and looked down at his board, Oren got a look at the yarmulke of skin in the center of the seated man's hair. There was something almost unbearably touching about a bald spot on a handicapped man.
What do you miss, please?
Oren smiled coolly.
Very little, I like to think.
Backtrack, USA citizen?
Yes.
You have how many years?
Age?
You have which age?
Age is 26.
Over 25?
That follow.
Oren was waiting for the ruse involving the pen that'd get him to sign something so that the very shy fan club would get their autograph. He tried to remember from Mario's childhood how long under blankets before it got unbearably hot and you started to smother and thrash. The man pretended to notate.
Employed? Self-employed? Unemployed?
Oren smiled. The first.
Please list what you miss.
The whisper of the vent, hush of the wine-colored hallway, vaguest whisper of rustling sheets behind, imagining the growing bubble of CO2 under the sheets.
Please list freestyle elements of your USA lifetime you recall, and or that present lack and miss.
I'm not sure I follow. The man flipped a page over to check.
Pan, yearn, winsome, nostalgia, lump of throat.
Flipping one more sheet.
Wistville as well.
You mean childhood memories. You mean like cocoa with half-melted marshmallows floating on top in a checker-tiled kitchen warmed by an enamel gas range, that sort of thing. Or omniscient doors at airports and star markets that somehow knew you were there and slid open before they disappeared. Where did those doors go?
Enamel is with the E.
And then some. Oren's gaze now was up at the ceiling's acoustic tile, the little blinking disc of the hall's smoke detector, as if memories were always lighter than air. The seated man stared blandly up at the throb of Oren's internal jugular vein. Oren's face changed a little. Behind him, under the blankets, the non-Swiss woman lay very calmly and patiently on her side, breathing silently into the portable O2 mask with canister from the purse beside her, one hand in the purse on the Schmeisser GBF miniature machine pistol.
I miss TV, Oren said, looking back down. He no longer smiled coolly.
The former television of commercial broadcast?
I do.
Raison, in several words or less, please. For the box after raison.
Displaying the board.
Oh, man.
Oren looked back up and away, at what seemed to be nothing, feeling at his jaw around the retromandibular's much tinier and more vulnerable throb. Some of this may sound stupid. I miss commercials that were louder than the programs. I miss the phrases, order before midnight tonight, and save up to 50% and more. I miss being told things were filmed before a live studio audience. I miss late-night anthems, and shots of flags and fighter jets, and leathery-faced Indian chiefs crying at litter. I miss sermonette and evensong, and test patterns, and being told how many megahertz something's transmitter was broadcasting at. He felt his face. I miss sneering at something I love. How we used to love to gather in the checkered-tiled kitchen in front of the old boxy cathode ray Sony, whose reception was sensitive to airplanes, and sneer at the commercial vapidity of broadcast stuff.
Vapidity?
Pretending to notate. I miss stuff so low denominator I could watch and know in advance what people were going to say.
Emotions of mastery, and control, and superiority.
and pleasure. You can say that again, boy. I miss summer reruns. I miss reruns hastily inserted to fill the intervals of writer strikes, actors' guild strikes. I miss Jeannie, Samantha, Sam and Diane, Gilligan, Hawkeye, Hazel, Jed, all the syndicated airwave haunters, you know? I miss seeing the same things over and over again. There were two muffled sneezes from the bed behind him, and the handicapped man didn't even acknowledge, pretending to write, brushing his string ties dangle away again and again as he wrote. Orin tried not to imagine the topography of the sheets the subject had sneezed into. He no longer cared about the ruse. He did feel tender somehow toward him. The man tended to look up at him like people with legs look up at buildings and planes.
You can, of course, view entertainments again and again without surcease, on tele-entertainment discs of storage and retrieval.
Orin's way of looking up, as he remembered, was nothing like the seated guy's way of looking up. But not the same. The choice, see? It ruins it somehow. With television, you were subjected to repetition. The familiarity was inflicted. Different now.
Inflicted.
I don't think I exactly know, Orin said, suddenly, dimly stunned and sad inside. The terrible sense, as in dreams, of something vital you've forgotten to do. The inclined head's bald spot was freckled and tan. Is there a next item?
Things to tell me you do not miss.
For symmetry.
Balance of opinion.
Orin smiled. Plus or minus.
Just so, the man said.
Orin resisted an urge to lay his hand tenderly over the arc of the disabled man's skull. Well, how much time do we have here? The skyscraper gawking aspect was only when the man's gaze went higher than Orin's neck. They were not shy or indirect, or even the eyes of someone in any way disabled, was what struck Orin later as odd. Besides the Swiss accent, the absence of a signature ruse, the subject's patience with the wait, and the absence of gasping when O pulled the covers abruptly back later. The man had looked up at Orin and flicked his eyes slightly past him, at the room behind with pantyless floor and humped covers. Orin was meant to see the glance past him.
Can return at the latter time which we specify. You are, comment dit, engaged?
Orin's smile wasn't as cool as he thought, as he told the seated figure that that was a matter of opinion. As at all DSAS-certified halfway facilities, Ennett House's resident curfew is 2330 hours. From 2300 to 2330, the staffer on night duty has to do head counts and sit around like somebody's mom waiting for different residents to come in. There's always ones that always like to cut it close and play with the idea of getting discharged for something picayune so it won't be their fault. Tonight, Clinette H. and the deeply whacked out Yolanda W. come back in from Footprints around 2315 in purple skirts and purple lipstick and ironed hair, tottering on heels and telling each other what a wicked time they just had. Esther Thrale undulates in a false fox jacket at 2320 as usual, even though she has to be up at like 0430 for the breakfast shift at the Provident Nursing Home, and sometimes eats breakfast with Gately, both of their faces nodding down perilously close to their frosted flakes. Chandler Foss and the spectrally thin April Cordelieu come in from someplace with postures and expressions that arouse comments and force Gately to log a possible issue about an in-house relationship. Gately has to bid goodnight to two craggy-faced brunette ex-residents who've been planted on the couch all night talking cults. Emil Minty and Nell Gunther and sometimes Gavin Dial, who Gately did 3 weeks of a municipal bit with once at Concord Farm, make a nightly point of going to smoke outside on the front porch and coming in only after Gately says twice he's got to lock the door, just as some limp, rebellious gesture. Tonight they're closely followed by a mustacheless Lance, who sort of oozes through the door just as Gately's going through his keys to get the key to lock it, and kind of brushes by and goes up to the three men without a word, which he's been doing a lot lately, which Gately has to log. plus the fact that it's now after 23:30, and he can't account for either the semi-new girl, Amy J., or, more upsetting, Bruce Green. Then Green knocks at the front door at 23:36. Gately has to log the exact time, and then it's his call whether to unlock the door. After curfew, staff doesn't have to unlock the door. Many a Bad News resident gets effectively bounced this way. Gately lets him in. Green's never come close to missing curfew before and looks god-awful. Skin potato white and eyes vacant. And a big quiet kid is one thing. But Green looks at the floor of Pat's office like it's a loved one, while Gately gives him the required ass-chewing. And Green takes the standard dreaded week's full house restriction in such a vacantly hangdog way, and is so lamely vague when Gately asks, does he want to tell him where he's been at, and why he couldn't make 23:30, and whether there's anything that's an issue that he might want to share with staff? So unresponsive that Gately feels like he has no choice but to pull an immediate spot urine on Green, which Gately hates doing not only because he plays cribbage with Green and feels like he's taken Green under the old Gately wing and is probably the closest thing to a sponsor the kid's got, but also because urine samples taken after Unit Number 2's clinics closed have to be stored overnight in the little staff miniature fridgelet in Don Gately's basement room, the only fridge in the house that no resident could conceivably dicky into. And Gately hates to have a warm, blue-lidded cup of somebody's goddamn urine in his fridgelet with his pears and polar seltzer, etc. Green submits to Gately's cross-armed presence in the men's head as Green produces a urine so efficiently and with so little bullshit that Gately is able to take the lidded cup between gloved thumb and finger and get it downstairs and tagged and logged and down in the fridgelet in time to not be late for getting the residents' cars moved, the night shift's biggest pain in the ass. But then his final head count at 23:45 reminds Gately that Amy J. isn't back, and she hasn't called. And Pat has told him the decision to discharge after a missed curfew is his call. And at 23:50, Gately makes the decision and has to get Treat and Belbin to go up into the five-woman room and pack the girl's stuff up in the same Irish luggage she'd brought it in Monday. And Gately has to put the trash bags on the front porch with a quick note explaining the discharge and wishing the girl good luck, and has to call Pat's answering device down in Milton and leave word of a mandatory curfew discharge at 23:50 hours, so Pat can hear about it first thing in the a.m. and schedule interviews to fill the available bed ASAP. And then, with a hissed curse, Gately remembers the anti-big hanging gut sit-ups he's sworn to himself to do every night before 0-100 hours, and it's 23:56. And he has time to do only 20 with his huge discolored sneakers wedged under the frame of the office's black vinyl couch before it's unavoidably time to supervise moving the residents' cars around. Gately's predecessor as male live-in staff, a designer narcotics man who's now, via Massachusetts rehab, learning to repair jet engines at East Coast Aerotech, once described residents' vehicles to Gately as a continuing boil on the ass of night staff. And it house lets any resident with a legally registered vehicle and insurance keep their car at the house, if they want, during residency, to use for work and nightly meetings, etc. And the Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital goes along. Except, they put authorized parking for all the unit's clients out in the little street right outside the house. And since Metro Boston's serious fiscal troubles in the third year of subsidized time, there's been this hellish municipal deal where only one side of any street is legal for parking, and the legal side switches abruptly at 0-100 hours, and cruisers and municipal tow trucks prowl the streets from 0-01 hours on, riding $95 tickets and or towing suddenly illegally parked vehicles to a region of the South End so blasted and dangerous, no cabbie with anything to live for will even go there. So, the interval, 23:55 hours to 0-05 hours in Boston, is a time of total but not very spiritual community, with guys in skivvies and ladies in mud masks staggering out yawning into the crowded midnight streets, and disabling their alarms, and revving, and all trying to pull out and do a U and find a parallel parking place facing the other way. There's nothing very mystifying about the fact that Metro Boston's battery and homicide rates during this 10-minute interval are the highest per diem, so that ambulances and paddy wagons are especially a prowl at this hour, too, adding to the general clot and snarl. Since the EMPHH unit's catatonics and enfeebled people rarely own registered vehicles, it's generally pretty easy to find places along the little road to switch to. But it's a constant sore point between Pat Modisian and the EMPHH Board of Regents that Enenhouse residents don't get to park overnight in the big off-street lot by the condemned hospital building. The lot's spaces are reserved for all the different units' professional staff, starting at 0600 hours, and EM security got sick of staff's complaints about drug addicts, poorly maintained autos, still sitting there taking up their spots in the AM. And that security won't consider changing the little EM streetlet's nightly side switch to 2300 hours, before Enid Houses' DSAS-required curfew. EM's board claims it's a municipal ordinance that they can't be expected to mess with just to accommodate one tenant, while Pat's memos keep pointing out that the Enfield Marine Hospital complex is state, not city-owned, and that Enid House residents are the only tenants who face the nightly car-moving problem, since just about everyone else is catatonic or enfeebled, and so on. But so every PM at like 2359, Gately has to lock up the lockers and Pat's cabinets and desk drawers and the door to the front office and put the phone console's answering machine on and personally escort all residents who own cars out post-curfew, outside, into the little nameless streetlet. And for somebody with Gately's real limited managerial skills, the headaches involved are daunting. He has to herd the vehicular residents together just inside the locked door. He has to threaten the residents he's herded together into staying together by the door while he clomps upstairs to get the one or two drivers who always forget and fall asleep before 0000. And this straggler collecting is a particular pain in the ass if the straggler's a female, because he has to unlock and press the mail coming up button by the kitchen, and the buzzer sounds more like a klaxon and wakes the edgiest female residents up with an ugly surge of adrenaline. And Gately, as he clomps up the stairs, gets roundly bitched out by all the mud-masked heads sticking out into the female hall. And he, by regulation, can't go into the sleeper's bedroom, but has to pound on the door and keep shouting out his gender and get one of the straggler's roommates to wake her up and get her dressed and to the bedroom door. So he has to retrieve the stragglers and chew them out and threaten them with both a restriction and a possible tow, while herding them, quick walking down the staircase to join the main car owner herd as quickly as possible before the main herd can, like, disperse. They'll always disperse if he takes too long getting stragglers. They'll get distracted or hungry or need an ashtray, or just get impatient and start looking at the whole car moving after curfew thing as an imposition on their time. Their early recovery denial makes it impossible for them to imagine their own car getting towed instead of, say, somebody else's car. It's the same denial Gately can see at work in the younger BU or C students when he's driving Pat's Aventura to the food bank or Purity Supreme, when they'll fucking walk right out in the street against the light in front of the car, whose brakes are fortunately in top shape. Gately's snapped to the fact that people of a certain age and level of, like, life experience believe they're immortal. College students and alcoholics/addicts are the worst. They deep down believe they're exempt from the laws of physics and statistics that ironly govern everybody else. They'll piss and moan your ear off if somebody else fucks with the rules, but they don't deep down see themselves subject to them, the same rules. And they're constitutionally unable to learn from anybody else's experience. If some jaywalking BU student does get splattered on Commonwealth, or some house resident does get his car towed at 005, your other students' or addicts' response to this will be to ponder just what imponderable difference makes it possible for that other guy to get splattered or towed, and not him, the ponderer. They never doubt the difference, They just ponder it. It's like a kind of idolatry of uniqueness. It's unvarying and kind of spirit-killing for a staffer to watch, that the only way your addict ever learns anything is the hard way. It has to happen to them.